everyone. Welcome to Kisco Oncology Voices. We are so glad you joined in. I'm your host, Matthew Currian, and I'm part of the Executive Committee for the Kentucky Society of Clinical Oncology, or Kisco. Every month, we'll bring you a fresh discussion on the latest oncology therapies, care, and advocacy in Kentucky.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Kisco podcast, where Kentucky's brightest minds in cancer care come together. I'm your host, Matt Currian, medical oncologist at St. Elizabeth's Young Family Cancer Center and part of the executive committee of Kisco. I'm joined today by two amazing colleagues, Molly Beck, who is our precision oncology pharmacist at St. Elizabeth, and Jordan Brady, who is one of our genetic counselors and clinical genetics coordinator at St. Elizabeth's. So welcome, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, thank you.
Of course. Really, today's topic is really going to focus on prostate cancer, and we'll talk a little bit about statistics. We'll talk a little bit about testing in terms of screening, and then talking a little bit about genetic screening, germline screening, and somatic testing, and how that affects treatment within the prostate cancer space, specifically within Kentucky as well, too. So just starting out, you know, I think that some statistics regarding prostate cancer within Kentucky itself. Kentucky has about 108 cases per 100,000 men, slightly below the average of 109 cases per 100,000 men in the U.S. as well, too. Mortality rates are pretty close to the national rate of about 18 per 100,000. And in 2025, there are expected to be about greater than 3,500 new cases and more than 400 deaths expected as a result of prostate cancer. One of the things that specifically in prostate cancer people may or may not know about is there was a bill that was passed called House Bill 52 that was passed in April 2024 that was sponsored by Dina Gordon and Governor Beshear, which was passed really to eliminate cost barriers to screening and follow-up for cancer screening tests and procedures without really imposing cost-sharing requirements like deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance. And that is now effective as of January of this year, with really the goal of reducing disparities and improving really early cancer detection as well, too. So really, when we talk about, you know, screening, guys, what are your guys' thoughts in terms of how do we screen people? We have different guidelines. We have the NCCN. We have USPSTF. We have American Cancer Society. What are your guys' thoughts in terms of screening, in terms of prostate cancer, and what things should we be considering? And each guideline has a little bit of some different recommendations. So how should we go about doing this?
I probably don't have a ton to add in this space. I mean, I will say I think that identifying men who are at higher risk because they have a germline mutation that was inherited mm-hmm. can be a good first step in trying to find people who should be having potentially earlier or more frequent screening. Beyond that, though, in general, don't have anything else.
Sure. And I think the thing, you know, with looking at the different guidelines, essentially, each guideline has a little bit of a different age recommendation. The USPSTF are traditionally the more conservative recommendations where they recommend PSA screenings starting at about age 55 to 69. And that's a grade C recommendation. They actually recommend against screening those that are above the age of 70. They don't really comment in terms of high-risk groups like Black men or family history. And many individuals follow this due to insurance coverages in different states as well, too. Whereas the American Cancer Society, it's maybe closer to about 50 for average risk individuals as well, too. The NCCN, I think, probably takes the strongest stance, I think, in terms of starting at 45 for average risk individuals, 40 for those that are higher risk as well, too. But I think the thing that I have to point out, I guess, you know, within Kentucky itself is that, you know, there's a fairly high incidence and mortality of individuals within Black and Appalachian populations due to prostate cancer as well, too. And I think a lot of that may come from in rural Appalachia, people maybe being diagnosed at a later stage, higher Gleason scores, less access to care. Whereas, you know, we know that Black men inherently will have just a higher incidence and twice the mortality as well, too. And, you know, those that are low income may have delayed diagnoses and maybe, again, limited access to care as well, too. So there's a couple of things I think we need to consider within this, that it can be a particularly confusing topic, especially for those that are primary care physicians as well, to talking with three different guidelines and knowing which one to use and considering someone's family history in terms of screening. It's something that I think is something we still need to work on, not only as a state, but nationally as well too. So let's dive into germline testing, Jordan. When you think about germline testing and those that have a new diagnosis of prostate cancer, who are the individuals that we should be testing really, and who are the people that we really should be focusing our attention to the most?
Yeah, so there are different guidelines across different organizations. So ASCO recommends genetic testing for any man with metastatic prostate cancer, so prostate cancer that's traveled from the original site. And they also recommend somatic testing with the germline testing or tumor testing. And then NCCN has separate guidelines, so it can be kind of hard to keep up with. But one thing that we've really been moving towards in the genetic space is we've started to develop programs where we offer genetic testing to all newly diagnosed patients. We've implemented this for our breast population as well as our ovarian population. And in our breast population, we found that guidelines were actually missing up to half of patients who had a pathogenic variant. And I actually found a specific trial for men with prostate cancer. And they examined the guidelines and found that about 42% of men who were diagnosed with prostate cancer and had a pathogenic variant identified did not actually meet NCCN guidelines, at least. So they looked specifically at those. So I think the overarching problem is that we are finding more and more that specific guidelines don't necessarily identify everyone who might have a positive result. Sometimes we'll look at things like family history, if they have related cancers like breast cancer, ovarian cancer, other men with prostate cancer, and sometimes we'll look at how advanced their prostate cancer is. But really, we are moving in that direction of offering, more and more patients that testing because we really just can't utilize guidelines to know who's going to be positive.
Definitely. And I think that, when we talk about folks that get germline testing, I think a lot of us, I think, do, germline testing in those that are metastatic in nature. But sometimes I think the people that are missed, I think that we see a lot are those that have high risk localized prostate cancer. They may not have metastatic disease or maybe have lymph node positive disease or have, variant histologies such as being intraductal or cribriform histologies. And I think that these are, groups of individuals I think are sometimes missed. And maybe they have family history, maybe they don't, but definitely folks that I think we should also include, within germline testing as well too. In terms of you spoke a little bit about, in terms of family history. Can you talk a little bit about, implications and cascade testing and what we do here at St. Elizabeth's as well too, and maybe it can be sort of a model potentially for others within the state in terms of trying to set up genetic screening programs essentially. What do we do that I guess that's a little bit different than everyone else as well?
Yeah, so when a patient tests positive, we then will provide them with letters to share with their family. A lot of patients don't realize actually that the genetic testing labs we work with, most of them do actually offer free testing for family members for a period of time. So those programs are really beneficial in getting people in and getting them access to that cascade screening or that additional genetic testing. And so we will usually meet with the family members, talk to them about this genetic finding and what specific implications it has for them, talk about insurance and protections and all of those things so they have that information up front, and then also order the testing. I think one thing that is unique about St. Elizabeth is we do also have a cancer prevention clinic here. So for patients that do test positive for a family mutation, they are able to be seen in that clinic and have someone manage those high-risk screenings. Because it can be really challenging for, family doctors who have a lot of other things to consider at each visit to manage those guidelines and stay on top of them as they change over time. And that's really the goal of that specialized clinic. So we really try to help that patient communicate with their family and get their family members tested so that they have that advantage of doing screening ideally before, cancer would develop so we could catch it early or even be preventative when possible.
Right. And tell me a little bit about in terms of, you and I have conversations every day with patients regarding, barriers to doing germline testing. I've had many patients say that, you know, they're worried about insurance coverage. They are concerned about privacy concerns of what individuals are going to do with that genetic information. How do you go about speaking to patients regarding some of these things as well, too? And what advice do you offer to people?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest advantages of having that genetic counseling session up front is we are able to talk with the patients about their concerns. In terms of insurance, a lot of people aren't aware that there is actually a law called GINA, or the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And so this actually protects people from genetic discrimination by health insurance and their employer. There are some exceptions there, but we often will talk to patients about that. I also think a lot of patients, you know, in the past, we know genetic testing was very, very expensive, often wasn't covered by insurance. Now, with most of the labs that we work with, the testing usually doesn't exceed a couple hundred dollars. And most of the labs have very generous patient assistance programs where we can kind of help reduce the cost even further for certain patients as well. So I think those two things are definitely things that were issues in the past that we're still trying to get the word out that it's a lot better now, and we have a lot of options to make this accessible to as many patients as possible. Yeah, I think in terms of barriers in the genetic space, and this is relevant for prostate cancer, I think there is this myth that these genetic mutations don't affect men as well, and that can deter some men from reaching genetic counseling. I hear that from patients a lot where they'll say, "Oh, I'm testing for my daughters," and they also have sons. And I think it's because, you know, people think of mutations like BRCA1 or BRCA2, where those can increase the risk for breast cancer, but they can also increase the risk for prostate cancer. And so I think a lot of people don't realize that men can also have these genetic risks, even if the gene might also increase the risk for female cancer.
Right, definitely, without a doubt. And then, you know, speaking a little bit in terms of, you know, somatic testing versus germline testing as well, to, you know, Molly and Jordan regarding this question, you know, so a lot of times we may get, you know, next generation sequencing, Tempus, whatever platform that you use up front, and then you may see some, you know, somatic mutations that are reported out that have very high variant allele frequencies, greater than 50%. What's your guys' approach, I guess, in terms of determining whether or not, you know, if that is a potentially germline or whether we need to do any additional germline testing, especially in the absence of maybe family history or other things as well, too? How do we distinguish? Because I think that's something that I think is sometimes confusing, I think, you know, on the provider side in terms of, you know, does this person need genetic testing or germline testing as well, too? Or is the somatic testing, especially in the prostate, sense, adequate or not?
Sure. Yeah. So we have multiple different things that we will look at. So, you know, like you mentioned, the variant allele frequency, we'll look at that and see, you know, what that percentage is. We'll also look at the specific gene, and if it is one that's commonly tested for on genetic testing panels. Also, if that particular gene mutation seems to fit with the patient's personal or family history. So, for example, a lot of patients have somatic TP53 mutations. And if someone actually has a germline mutation in their gene, their risk of cancer is very, very high. We typically see childhood cancer as cancers before the age of 30. And so, if they have many, many unaffected relatives, we wouldn't necessarily be as concerned that that could be germline. There is also matched normal testing through some labs where they'll do essentially a screen to see if it might also be germline, though it's important to say that that is not germline testing, and it still needs to be confirmed by a germline testing lab. So those are the things that we look at. And really, there is no surefire way to say if something is only exclusive to the tumor or if it is inherited. So if the patient's really motivated or there is that level of concern, I would say it's always worth a conversation of, you know, having the patient meet with a genetic counselor, take a detailed family history, and seeing, you know, if that patient is interested in doing testing, because that's really the only surefire way to confirm that.
Sure. So if you saw someone with maybe, you know, a BRCA mutation on somatic testing, would that prompt germline testing in your mind as well too? Or would it sort of, you know, like you said, depend on, you know, sort of the other, you know, family history, other parts of the puzzle as well too?
Yeah, I think if, you know, we do have databases that record different variants. And so I usually would look and see on the germline side of things, is that variant normally considered a positive result through our labs that we test through? And if so, I would say I definitely would consider that for that patient. You know, again, we can't rule out that it could be a possibility that this is also an inherited mutation and not just in their tumor. And, you know, in many cases, we can look at the family history as well, but we also will see many patients who do have these mutations and they don't have a family history for whatever reason, or sometimes in rare cases, people can even have brand new mutations that are germline, but they weren't necessarily inherited from a parent. So lots of potential explanations there for that, but I would say, yeah, for genes like BRCA, especially if the patient has a related cancer, that would definitely be a flag.
So somatic biomarker testing is really kind of universally recommended for all patients with metastatic prostate cancer, and there's some other recommendations to consider in patients who have regional disease. But probably one of the main things we're looking for would be somatic or germline variants in HRR genes or homologous recombination repair genes. So thinking BRCA1 and 2, thinking PALB2, thinking ATM. But somatic tests can also potentially yield results in other biomarkers that could help guide therapy. So while the data isn't necessarily as strong, there are recommendations to consider testing for MSI status and MMR status for patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer if they have MSI high disease or deficient mismatch repair. They could be candidates for immunotherapy. And then we also have some tumor agnostic drug approvals for various biomarkers like NTRK, RET, or HER2. And so maybe not in first line or second line in the castrate resistant setting, but maybe, you know, once patients have exhausted standards of care, these could also be reasonable to test for if they could offer or open up options for other targeted medications for patients.
And how common is that, Molly, in terms of seeing, you know, something like that as well too? You know, I can recall from my own experience, you know, I've had very few, you know, individuals that have had MSI high but have you know, remained on Keytruda or similar immunotherapy and have responded actually quite well to treatment, you know, in the castrate resistant setting. How common is it to see something like that as well too, or even some of those more rare like NTRK or HER2 positive or things like that as well?
So I don't have specific incidences off the top of my head, but I would agree with you that they are relatively rare in the grand scheme of things. However, when we do identify these things, especially for instance in the case that you mentioned, in a patient who, for instance, has deficient mismatch repair, they can have very robust responses to therapy. And so, as part of my role as the precision oncology pharmacist, when I'm just, you know, making sure we're testing for all available biomarkers, sometimes I get pushback from providers saying, you know, the incidence of that specific variant is so uncommon and in this malignancy. But I think that's kind of the point of precision medicine. We're not looking at what the incidence is globally. If we can find that in our specific patient and offer them a treatment, that would be our goal. So I'm always looking for ways that we can exhaust biomarker, making sure we're looking for all targetable biomarkers, because we always want to have additional lines of therapy for our patients if they need it due to progression or they need it due to toxicity or intolerance, whatever the issue may be.
Definitely. And you think that, you know, usually with a lot of these different platforms, there's a little bit variable from one platform to the other, that all of them have these options to be able to add all of these different tests, if you so choose so as well to correct as well too. Because like you said, you know, some are better detected by RNA testing as well too versus DNA testing. You know, some that are, you know, mutations are better detected. Not even on the prostate cancer space, but some better in liquid biopsies than solid biopsies as well too. A problem we traditionally face a lot of the times within the prostate cancer space is that when we're trying to get tissue for next generation sequencing, a lot of these individuals unfortunately have bone only metastases, and that obviously creates an issue in terms of harvesting a biopsy that will be able to be set up for next generation sequencing. So how do you approach, I guess, the conversation in terms of, doing solid biopsy, solid and liquid biopsies, liquid biopsies? What's your sort of approach to that for the most part, Molly?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I think where a lot of confusion comes in, not only with providers, but also nursing in clinic. So as you mentioned, tissue is the gold standard for NGS. With our current technologies, certain tests that are IHC or immunohistochemistry based are not able to be run on liquid. So think PD-L1, HER2, those sorts of things require tissue. But as you mentioned, especially in prostate cancer, bone may be our only tissue that's available, and unfortunately, basically what the pathologist does to make that histologic diagnosis does not render that sample usually very, very well for NGS testing. And so if tissue is not available, we can consider what we call liquid biopsy, so a blood sample. But when you are considering a liquid biopsy, you need to make sure that you're timing that collection appropriately. So a liquid biopsy is basically looking at all of the DNA that is shed from all of the cells in the body. So healthy cells that are just going through their normal growth cycles, as well as tumor DNA, as tumor cells are growing and overturning. So with that being said, if we have a patient with low burden disease, or even someone who is responding to therapy, let's say in the metastatic setting, we would likely suspect that they should not have a lot of circulating tumor DNA because their disease is not creating that much. So we would essentially, in order to optimize yield of liquid biopsies, would want to get it at diagnosis in patients with high burden disease, or get it upon either biochemical recurrence or if there's signs of radiographic progression, when we would expect there to be higher levels of ctDNA in the blood.
No, that's an excellent point. I think something that is very much not emphasized, I think, in terms of the timing being very crucial, especially in not only prostate cancer, but other settings as well, too. So thanks for that. And specifically within prostate cancer, we talk really about, maybe three or four different trials that all are testing really PARP inhibitors, in combination with other oral ARPIs as well, too, with Propel, Magnitude, Talipro2, BRCAway as some of the three or four main trials that are out there, with the majority being phase threes as well, too, and BRCA2 or BRCAway being a phase two. When you look at this data exactly, what's your interpretation of the data in terms of, whether or not this is these medications, these PARP inhibitors, are really going to be effective in those that have HRR mutations or not? And if so, which ones in your mind are potentially going to be the ones that are going to benefit the most?
So I think what is most significant is that all of the trials that looked at PARP inhibitors for variants in HRR genes did show a progression-free survival benefit compared to hormonal therapies alone. So that's significant, especially since these are all oral regimens that can be more attractive to patients, kind of getting away from some of the more stereotypical cytotoxic chemotherapies and those sorts of things. And then actually, olaparib has an overall survival benefit in the first-line setting for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. So that's significant as well. Broadly speaking, there's data to support if we're matching patients with targeted therapies. Oftentimes, these patients have better outcomes than if we're giving them non-targeted therapies. So this offers a very awesome opportunity to make impactful interventions up front if we can kind of identify the specific molecular pathways that could be really driving this patient's cancer.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's an interesting question in the sense of, obviously, it's, now been studied in multiple trials now, and the, where prostate cancer in the, castrate resistant setting is going is rapidly evolving with many new approvals that really are changing sort of the landscape of how we're treating individuals. With lutetium radioligand treatment now being approved potentially before chemotherapy as well too, as something that may shift practice as well too. And then really when I think about these trials, I always struggle sometimes in terms of trying to understand where these fit in terms of the treatment landscape. Because when we're talking about those that are castrate resistant, a lot of times, those individuals may have already had an oral ARPI in the form of abiraterone, enzalutamide, or others as well too. And really, when you look at the control arms of all these trials, PROPEL, MAGNITUDE, TALAPRO, they all compare against second ARPIs, which we know in the real world, although it's done in many community settings, really only has a response rate of roughly about 5 to 15% in the second line setting. And so it is something that I sort of question the control arms in these groups, and really, it sort of puts into question exactly, how effective are these PARP inhibitors in combination or even alone as well too. But clearly, I think you can see really within all these trials that there's definitely a signal within, those that are HER2 positive, and specifically maybe even BRCA2 being the ones I particularly see having maybe the strongest evidence. What's your thought in terms of those other maybe less prevalent ones, such as ATM and others similar to that as well too? What's your thought in terms of if someone has that, should we be offering this to patients? And really, in what sequence should we potentially be ordering this as well too?
These are all excellent questions, and if you asked multiple people, you may get different answers.
Sure, yeah.
To start, I think you make a very good point about what HRR genes may be involved. So, a lot of these trials kind of stratify patients or kind of divide patient result and analysis into like BRCA cohorts and then other HRR genes. And there are some nuances in terms of kind of what other genes they're including. So you mentioned PALB2, ATM, oftentimes those are included. But some of the less common ones like NBN and MRE11, I believe, are included in some of the trials and not the others. So I guess whenever I am looking at a patient, looking at their specific variant, understanding if that actually matches the therapy that is being requested from the provider. So I wouldn't necessarily say all PARP inhibitors are the same, and that if anyone has any variant involved in homologous recombination, that we should, be giving them any of the options. I would want to try to stick to the clinical trial criteria as best as we can. But I always try to look at if they have outcomes or subgroup analyses based on that specific variant. Because a lot of these publications also kind of note that a lot of any of the survival benefit or benefit is seen as often driven by the BRCA cohorts. So I think that brings up an interesting question, looking, if there's additional outcomes data on the variant level is important. If someone had a lesser known, less represented variant, I would potentially consider other options for treatment before necessarily like jumping to a PARP. Again, just because of questionable efficacy. And then with sequencing, I think that that offers a unique challenge as well, depending, on what patients have received in earlier stages, especially as we can use like Abby in a localized high-risk setting, those sorts of things. So I think kind of as in precision oncology, especially like in the lung space broadly, where our agents in the metastatic setting are being studied, to prevent disease recurrence, how do we sequence those things when patients progress? Do they need washout periods? Could we think about, like platinum-free intervals or refractory treatments in that regard? So it's obviously all a patient-specific discussion, but I think this is where attention to detail really comes into play, understanding which HRR gene is impacted and how represented those patients were in the associated clinical trials.
Definitely. I know I 100% agree with you. And I don't think anyone knows at this point in terms of sequencing as well too, of where these typically fall as well too. I've seen individuals that have, used it as soon as, we've found something in the castrate-resistant setting as well to you potentially trying a combination like this. But a lot of times people are maybe being exposed to, docetaxel, or, now with the new lutetium-117 approval, prior to chemotherapy, I think that, it will sort of shift in terms of, before I think we were very much using chemotherapy and docetaxel for those that became castrate-resistant. Fairly upfront as well too, and now with lutetium being within here, and then now also having PARP inhibitors as well too, if you have it, I think we have to have these discussions with patients in terms of what's going to work best for them and their comorbidities, other toxicities related to things as well too. One thing I do always bring up with individuals though is that traditionally if folks have had chemotherapy in today's day and age, before all of these trials, and maybe have had docetaxel, maybe had another cabazitaxel potentially after that, maybe moving forward with lutetium and then going for a PARP inhibitor. The more common side effects with PARP inhibitors typically are, myelosuppression, anemia, typically a fatigue, other things like that as well too. And it is something that I tell folks that eventually, the more chemo you potentially have, the more bone marrow suppression you may have, and the more degree of anemia you may potentially see. And fatigue and anemia go hand in hand with quality of life as well too. So that's something that I just talk to patients about, when we're making those decisions in terms of the sequencing of things as well too, and what their disease is doing at the same time. But I think there's a lot of things I think that are very exciting within the prostate cancer space that I think offer a lot of options for patients. And I think that's great in terms of that. Now we have multiple options for patients. Now, like you said, it's very much a discussion in terms of a tailored approach for folks with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So looking ahead, what are your guys' thoughts in terms of, if we as an organization within KISCO really had to focus on two or three priorities for Kentucky within prostate cancer in terms of germline or somatic testing or things like that, what would you say would be your two or three top priorities in terms of working maybe with policymakers or clinicians, or what would you say would potentially help in terms of getting more people potentially tested in the germline somatic testing? What would you say would be your two or three top priorities?
Yeah, I think that, with ASCO's guidelines, especially recommending all men with metastatic prostate cancer having offered germline and somatic testing, I'm sure that we're probably not, across the state of Kentucky, I wouldn't be surprised if that's not happening. And so I would say, more education for providers and, more offering of that to men with prostate cancer. And really, on the germline side, it's not only beneficial for that patient, but for their family. And I think, making sure that that patient at least has the option to that additional information, I would say would be one thing that I would definitely want to be highlighted. Because I'm sure I don't have specific numbers, but I'm sure that across the state of Kentucky, especially when you get into more rural areas, we're definitely not offering that to every person. And in current times, we can even do telemedicine and send patient kits to their house. So there's a lot of options where we could offer testing to patients who maybe aren't close to a genetic center.
Definitely, 100% agree with you. I think that telegenetics is where I was sort of thinking in terms of maybe being able to catch individuals sooner, especially with family histories. And really with that, I think that you can't just do one thing. I think you have to really fund, maybe in more rural parts of the state and Appalachia, funding maybe mobile screening for mobile blood phlebotomies and getting PSA screens on folks that traditionally have been missed. And again, with that, then, if you find those that have IPSA is getting them plugged in with the urologist, and then expanding telegenetics as a result of it. Exactly, I have the same exact thought as you do, Jordan. And really, in those areas of the state where we don't have as many genetic counselors, being able to be present in those areas of the state as well too, or maybe even oncologists as well too, and other providers. I think it's important to be able to still offer those services to individuals as well too, and really support rural navigation programs and invest in outreach and education as well too. And I think many states have done similar things as well too, that I think it would be a good investment in terms of trying to expand some of that access to testing.
Yeah.
Mal, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to add, I actually found a statistic that we only have about 3 to 5 genetic counselors per 500,000 people in the state of Kentucky, according to the Government Accountability Office. So also just kind of encouraging more genetics professionals in the state, as well as, even if certain centers can't have genetics professionals, like you said, training oncologists to potentially take that role. I
Definitely,
think
without a doubt.
with that makes a really good point in terms of having people with specialized knowledge in these sorts of things. Like, obviously, as an oncologist, Dr. Curran, you're well aware that you have multiple competing priorities throughout a day. Clinics are busy, there are lots of patient needs above and beyond kind of, the somatic and germline space. And so, yes, there are a lot of vendors who are working to develop their tests to be smarter and more intuitive so that you, as an oncologist, can quickly look at it and interpret the results. But there are still a lot of nuances and details that may be overlooked in a busy clinic. And so having dedicated staff who can really take the time to analyze those, follow up on things that may not be as in common, be available for patient discussions and questions, I think all prove very valuable, especially, for my side of things, if we are finding somatic variants, that is step one. But then step two, oftentimes these targeted drugs have very high costs associated with them. And as you mentioned, can
Right.
also have a lot of side effects. So there's a whole piece of, just genetic stewardship as well. Like, yes, we've ordered the test, but then are we interpreting them and applying those findings appropriately to make sure we are maximizing efficacy and minimizing toxicity for patients?
Correct. 100% agree with you, Molly. I think that it just because there's something there doesn't mean that it may be something that could be actionable as well too. And I think that although it's nice that we have options, you're right, we got to be good stewards of how we're using those treatments because they do all come with different side effects as well too. All right. Well, thank you, Molly and Jordan, for sharing such valuable insights. Prostate cancer does remain a critical challenge in Kentucky, but I think with focused efforts on access, innovation, equity, we can really change the narrative. So thanks again for tuning in to the inaugural Kisco podcast. Stay well and stay informed. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Kisco Oncology Voices, a resource of Kisco. Head to the show notes if you'd like more information on the topics we discussed today. We hope you'll follow along with us. Make sure to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app so you'll have the next episode as soon as it's released. Also, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop us a line at blawrence@acc-cancer.org. We'll catch you next time. Thanks.